Rabbi Manny and the lecture on Keturah, the Mystery Matriarch. So I'm sure you're more regular here than I am. In fact, you can't be less regular here than I am because this is the first time I've ever done this slot. So you can tell me, and based on the weather and what people feel they can cope with, what the normal format is. They've given me a slot officially between 1 and 3. One thing's for sure, you can't possibly sit here and listen to me talk for 2 hours. So what normally happens in this slot? You have a break for a 10-minute break at 2 o'clock? Okay, perfect. Okay, very good. So what we'll do is we'll go through... Yes, the watch is working. Will you give me hand signals, namely, when it's getting a little closer to 2 o'clock? We can do that. This is a small group. Let me ask, is everybody local? Or people have come from far? I know, namely, she's my sister-in-law from Woodside Park. But where is...
Highgate.
Golders Green. I've heard of Golders Green, yeah. Hendon, you have Woodside Park. Woodside Park.
Mill Hill,
and a gentleman there, probably local. Edgware, excellent. So, you've made a connection already. Good, they have to come here to make that connection. Okay, so my name is, yes, I'll tell you a little bit about myself. My name is Anthony Manning. I'm originally from Leeds. But it's been some time since I lived in Leeds. In spite of the fact that I come from Leeds, yes. Well, my accent was diluted when I was at university, and my wife and I were together at Oxford University. She's not here; she's running around outside. Sarah and I did law at Oxford, and I became a lawyer. She had more sense. She didn't become a lawyer. We lived in Hendon. I was a lawyer for a number of years, living in Hendon. I worked in a city practice near Fleet Street, mostly in property law. I was a partner in the firm there. In 2002, we decided, Tara and I, that it was time to leave. I think the line is to leave the profits of the law for the law of the profit. We decided to get out of Hendon, and we went to Yerushalayim. I, for many years, been giving shiurim here and shiurim there, and I very much wanted to do something more in depth in terms of my own learning. And I studied for a few years in Israel and took various different sneakers in different places, and ended up in teaching, which is not something I ever intended to do when I was at school, perhaps, but it's something I realized I always wanted to do and very much enjoyed doing. So I mostly focus now on teaching young women. Post high school, on the whole, girls who come for a year in Israel or a year plus in Israel, and also postgraduates who come after college if they didn't get a chance to learn before. So that's what I do most of the time. I'm the co-director of a program called Midrashet Tehillah, which I've actually just joined. I'm starting there in September, so there's all sorts of work to do there. So that's basically who I am and what I do. We're in London for a few weeks. On a slightly extended trip, speaking a little bit here and there. Excuse me. I'm going up north to see my parents. My parents are planning to make Aliyah, which is very exciting, and we're very excited for them and for ourselves as well. So I'm going to help them get ready a little bit for that. They're coming hopefully at the end of the year. And basically, that's any other information you can get from my wife. She'll be more interesting to speak to than I am. And I've also known Mrs. Armstrong Rafi for many, many years, and had connections of different kinds here as well. Fine. This slot, as you know, because you signed up for it, is talking about interesting and unusual personalities in Tanakh. And I suggested, when they asked me if I'd like to do this slot, maybe we could talk about Keturah. So she said, well, I said, has anyone talked a lot about Keturah? There was sort of silence on the phone. Don't think so. Does anyone know anything about Keturah? Not a lot. So I said, perfect, this is exactly the right person to speak about, since we're trying to highlight these personalities in Tanakh. So what I've done here is I've brought you a sheet. Good job we've got the time, because there are 37 sources, and I'd like to examine Keturah from 3.5 angles. 3 main angles, and maybe at the end a little bit something to leave us with something more fun to remember about it as well, halakhically. But I'd like to look at Keturah. We'll see soon what the text says about her. I'd like to look at the pshat. We'll talk a little bit about what pshat is, understanding of what Keturah, what's her purpose. Maybe this is not going to work. Maybe I'll put this. We can look a little bit on the pshat level of what Keturah is there in the text to do, and then we'll look at the drash, which Chazal, the rabbis, have a completely different way.
I'm going to disturb your papers now. Of looking at Keturah.
Okay. The rabbis have a very different approach to looking at Keturah, and they bring out a very different story, and we'll maybe talk a little bit about what they're trying to do and why they're trying to do it, what drash is and why they look at it differently from Shas. And then I'd like to look a little bit at a sod angle. I'm not a Kabbalist, so you'll have to ask your local Orthodox Kabbalist what they really think of what's going on, but there are certain more mystical angles that come out of Keturah that the Hasidic thinkers want to pull out, and the Kabbalistic thinkers, the Zohar, etc. And we'll look a little bit about that, at that as well. So by the time we finish, I suspect that between us we'll know more about Keturah than most people know. Most people even know that there is to know. One of my children, my son, I asked him to ask one of his rabbeim, who is a Tanakh person, a specialist in Tanakh, what he knows about Keturah, because I said, look, you can maybe do a bit of research for me. And in fact, my son Asher did quite a lot of research. He went up to his teacher and said, Harav, ma ata yodea Keturah? So he looked at him and he went, Klum, which is basically nothing. What do you know about Keturah? Nothing. Klum. So to start from Klum, we'll end up with quite a lot more than that. So let's have a look at number one. There are two places in Tanakh where Keturah is mentioned. One is the obvious text in Bereishit, where it comes up in Parashat Chayitzara. Let's have a look at number one. Vayosef Avraham vayikach isha ushma Keturah. Now, the first word is an interesting word, Vayosef. Again. He did something again. Okay? Abraham. And he took a wife, Ushma Keturah, and her name was Keturah, and we'll see that the order of those words becomes important. But Heled lo et, and she gave birth to him, she bore for him a little sea of 8 sons. Et Zimram, et Yokshan, et Medan, the et Midian so far is the one that people probably have heard of, the et Yishbak, the et Shuach. Okay? Those are the sons that she bore to Abraham. The Yokshan Yalad et Shiva. Yokshan, the next generation, he gave birth to Shiva, the et Dedan, and Dedan. So that's another generation down, which is, if you imagine the children of Keturah are the same generation of Yitzchak. The grandchildren, now these two we just mentioned, Shiva, which actually becomes famous later, and those are Sheba. Shiva is Malkat Shiva, is the queen of Sheba, okay? And we'll see why that connected in the whole Saudi Arabian Peninsula soon. The Et Dedan, they're the same level as Yaakov, the grandchildren, if you like, of Abraham. Ubnei Dedan, and the children of Dedan, Hayu Ashurim, Ulutushim, Ulaumim. In three rather obscure names. This is not Ashur. Ashur, Assyria, was born long, long time before this. This is someone else called Ashurim, Letushim, and Leumim. And this generation is the same generation as the tribes of Reuben, Shimon, Levi, Yehuda, etc. So we have, if you like, four generations, just like we have with Abraham, Yitzchak, Yaakov, and the Shvatim. We have four generations also with Keturah. We have Abraham, Keturah's children, grandchildren, and a couple of grandchildren. Uvnei Midian, we see now Midian's line, Epha, the Efer, the Chanoch, which is interesting because that's a name we have seen before. There are some names which are used multiple times in Tanakh. There's a few Korach, which is Pasha. There's not just one Korach, there's a few Shauls. And here we see another Chanoch. It's interesting, some names you never see again anywhere. It's nothing to do with Shir, but I suppose it is a little bit. Avram. As far as I'm aware, and please go away and research this and prove me wrong and send me an email, there is nobody in Jewish history from Abraham in the Torah until the Middle Ages who was called Abraham apart from that one Abraham. I'm not aware of any other person called Abraham. No one in the time of Tanakh was ever called Abraham. We have not one of the Tanaim or the Amoraim, not one of the rabbis of the Talmud or the Mishnah called Abraham. Until the time of the late Gaonim, all of a sudden everybody's called Abraham. Everyone's called Abraham. The Ibn Ezra is called Abraham, and the Rambam called his son Abraham, and everyone's called Abraham. Why for 2,000 years, literally, there's no Abraham, and then all of a sudden there are lots of Abrahams? Ishmael, there are. Oh yeah, Ishmael, you get plenty. But Abraham, you don't get. So answers on a postcard, please, if anyone still has a postcard. And
let me know. I have a theory as to why it might be, but I'm not sure it's true. So we see all of those people here, the Avida, the Elda'a, the Kol Eilev and the Keturah. All of these people, different generations of children of Keturah. So that's the family. Vayitan Abraham es kol asher lo liYitzchak. Abraham gave everything that he owned to Yitzchak. Ulevnei haPilag Shim, and to the sons of the concubines, we'll have to talk about Pilag Shim in a minute, Ashela Abraham, which Abraham had, Natan Abraham Matanot, he gave gifts. Now there's a couple of questions already. First of all, who are these Pilag Shim? I mean, we haven't seen any Pilag Shim yet. We know he had a wife called Hagar, we see he has a wife called Keturah, but who are these Pilag Shim? We'll talk about that soon. And what are these gifts that he gave? He just said he gave everything to Yitzchak. What's he giving to these other people? So he gives to the children of the Pilag Shim, Matanot. Vishalchem me'al Yitzchak b'no, and he sent them away from Yitzchak. Ba'odenu chai, while he was still alive, meaning it was a very important point of Avram's life to get these sons to move away from Yitzchak. Where? Kedma el Eretz Kedem, eastwards to the land of the east. A bit of a sort of stress on the east. So they went to the east. Where is Eretz Kedem? So we'll see where Eretz Kedem is. That's all we see in the Torah. So what do we have? We have a mishpachology. We have a line of generations of different children, grandchildren, great-grandchildren of Avraham Avinu through Keturah. We see that he gave everything that he had to Yitzchak. He gave gifts. We don't know what they were to these children. And he sent them to the east away from Yitzchak, so they wouldn't be near Yitzchak. Okay. The first commentary that we have on the Torah is really Divrei HaYamim. Divrei HaYamim, which is the book of, we need to call it Chronicles, is part of the Tanakh. But it's written in many ways much later in the biblical period as a commentary a little bit back on the Tanakh. So it's a kind of commentary in and of itself. So Divrei HaYamim is a very useful tool to use to try and understand what's going on here. So let's have a look at Divrei HaYamim number 2, and then we'll see the other source here in Tanakh. Bnei Abraham, Yitzchak, v'Yishmael. Here it lists the two sons of Yitzchak and Yishmael. Apparently they're the only two sons. Eila told Atam, and these are their generations. Bechor Yishmael Nevayot, goes to the children of Yishmael, Nevayot, the Kedar, the Adbael, Mivsam, Nishma, the Duma, Masah, Hadad, the Tema. These are all sons of Yishmael. Yetur, Nafish, the Kedma. Eila Haim Bnei Yishmael. How many did we have there? 12 sons of Yishmael. And of course, what are the 12 sons of Yishmael parallel? 12 tribes of Yaakov. So we see that just like Abraham set up, if you like, a system of 12 tribes of Yaakov living in Canaan, there was a system of 12 tribes of Yishmael, and we just listed them living wherever the Yishmaelim live. We'll see that soon. Ubnei Keturah, would you like to see?
Ubnei Keturah, and now it mentions Keturah, the children of Keturah.
And we're on source 2. It lists Bnei Keturah Pilegesh Abraham. Oh, now we see that Divrei HaYamim calls Keturah a Pilegesh. What was she called in source number 1? An Isha. What's the difference between a Pilegesh and an Isha? We'll see in a minute. We'll see. So he calls Keturah a Pilegesh Abraham. Who does she have? Yalda. And we see the same list. At Zimran, the Yavshan, Umadan, Umidyan, the Yishbak, the Shuach. Okay, 6. I think I said 8 at the beginning, but it's 6. Ubnei Yavshan, Sheva v'Dadan. Ubnei Midyan, Eifa, v'Efel, v'Chanoch, v'Avida, v'Elda'a, Kol Eile Bnei Keturah. These are the same names that we see. Not that there are other names that are not here, but all these names are also the names we saw in Bereshit. So, in Divrei HaYamim, we see Keturah is mentioned again. This time it is a Pelegesh, okay, a Pelegesh of Avram. And her sons are listed together with the sons of Yishmael, all of these families together. One of the things that Rabbi Yoel ben Nun, who is a very important figure in Tanakh, he's actually a very interesting man. I don't know if you know Rabbi Yoel ben Nun. He's one of my sons' rebbeim in Har Etzion. Rabbi Yoel ben Nun is one of these iconic characters. He was one of the paratroopers in 1967 that took Har Habayit, that took Temple Mount during the Six-Day War. And he went on to be a major figure in Tanakh, also in Israeli politics to some degree, and in Tanakh thinking. And he today is one of the big Jewish thinkers in Tanakh. He lives in Al-Shvut, just down the road from us, he actually said an interesting thing to Asher, to my son, which was that the Bible, the Torah has a very anti-Pelegish focus. It does not support the idea of Pelegish. Nowhere does he mention the idea that you can have a Pelegish. However, later on, we'll see what exactly Pelegish is, later on in Tanakh, in the time of the kings and afterwards, Pelegishim were more acceptable in many ways, and therefore maybe Divrei HaYamim doesn't have the same sensitivity to be anti-Pelegish, if you like, the Torah wanted to stress that she was an Isha, not a Pelegish, but later on maybe it's a little bit more acceptable to talk about Pelegishim. In fact, it's very interesting, the Torah itself seems to have a quite negative view of having more than one wife in the family. Any example where there's more than one wife in the family is a disaster. You just go through them, Sarah and Hagar, Yaakov with Rachel and Leah and Bilhah and Zilpah. It's giving clearly a picture that the happiest marriages are the monogamous marriages. And maybe later on that was less of an issue. Although even then, if you look through Tanakh, how many happy marriages are there where there's more than one wife? I can't think of many. Think of Elkanah with Pnina and Chana. Not a particularly happy situation. Moshe. So who did Moshe marry? He married Tzipora. And then maybe he married an Isha Cushit. In last week's parsha, he talks about an Isha Cushit. Is that Tzipora? Is that another woman that he married? And if so, where's she from? That's for another shiur. Maybe that's for next year. When we've done with Kippura, we can talk about the Isha Cushit and see why there is a woman from Sudan or Ethiopia suddenly appears in Parshas Balotcha as Moshe's wife. But that's not for now.
And he was supposed to be Among the tribes of Israel, because they couldn't have had such a
correct. Correct, in that sense. Although even that has a built-in sort of slightly snobbery in it. We see that that Yosef used to hang out with the Bnei HaPelegishim because the other brothers didn't want him around them, and they said you can hang out with Dan and Asher and Naphtali because they're the lower grade brothers rather than the higher grade. There's always this sort of tension in there. Are you one of the sons of the wives or the sons of the Pelagic, etc.? But let's have a look from a pshat level as to what is the role of Keturah. And I think this is very fascinating, and I want to suggest to you that the purpose on a pshat level in the text of Keturah is as follows. Avraham Avinu is meant to be the father of many, many nations. Not just the Jewish nation. That was a promise that was given to him at the beginning of Lech Lecha. Avraham Goyim. Okay? And he went from Avram to Avraham. He had to populate the Middle East. That is Abraham's job. And that involves not just Jews, but Jews plus Arabs. What we now call Arabs. We'll see there's a talk that says how they ended up getting the name Arabs. But all of these sons that the name Yishmael, they're all coming from Abraham. The Bnei Keturah, all coming from Abraham. Even the extended family of Lot's children, Lot was part of Abraham's Mishpacha, who are Lot's children, Ammon, Moab, etc., the Moabites, the Ammonites, these are all people who is the fulfillment, who are the fulfillment of the promise to Abraham that your children will be the children who inherit this land. And we'll have to define what is this land. Because this land, maybe that picture on the wall behind you, okay, which is very, you know, it's interesting, I did not used to see Israel that way round, okay, although having, you know, east of the top is maybe a more ancient minhag, but whatever, but is it that land? Or is it a much broader, greater land, which includes other countries that we have that we know about today as well? So let's have a look here. So that's what I want to suggest, and we'll see how that's brought out. Who was Keturah, first of all? Well, the rabbis have a difference of opinion here, number three. He Hagar. He Keturah, same woman. Hagar is Keturah, say the rabbis. The rabbi Teinu Amrim, but the other, Dibre Rebbe, sorry, that's the view of Rebbe Yudah Not. The rabbi Teinu Amrim, but the other rabbis say, no, Isha Acheret Natal. He took another wife. So already within Chazal, there's a difference of opinion as to how to read it. Do you read it that Keturah was the same as Hagar? And we'll see the evidence for why Keturah might be Hagar soon. Or do you learn it that she was another wife? And on a Pshat level, it seems very clear she was another wife. Look at the Rashbam, always a Pshat focus in number 4. Lefi HaPshat, Ein Zo Hagar. This is not Hagar. By the way, how would you define Pshat? I'm sure he talks about this a lot in this forum. What is Pshat? The text of the Tanakh with what?
Without,
on the door and check in our commentary.
Every translation is
the same. Of course it is. So Pshat is, it's interesting, Pshat is not that simple. If Pshat was so simple, why is everyone disagreeing, Rashi and the Rashbam and the Ibn Ezra about Pshat? Pshat is not so simple, and it's certainly not literal. It's not the literal meaning of the text, necessarily, when it talks about the Yad Hashem, the Yad Chazakah, Zroh Nesuyah. The Pshat in Yad Chazakah is not some big hand coming down from the sky, sort of Monty Python-esque, out of the clouds. That's not what's going on. So Pshat is not simple, and Pshat is not literal, necessarily. It could be literal, but it's not always. Pshat, the word Pshat is from Poshet. Poshet, what does Poshet mean? It means surface. It is the surface level. Okay? Poshet means to spread out. So Pshat really is the surface level of the text, given no other fact, no other information other than what you see in the text. And the text is, of course, words, there's subtext, which is part of the context. That all grammar, that all feeds what is the Pshat. And so the Rashbam is saying here, on a Pshat level, this clearly is not Hagar. So too, the Rashbam says in number 5, the Pilag Shin that he refers to in number 1, these B'nai Pilag Shin, are in fact Hagar and Keturah. Why it calls them Pilag Shin, we'll see in a minute. The difference between a woman, a wife, Isha, and a Pilagesh, is a difference of opinion between Rashi and the Ramban. Number 6, Rashi says, Rashi is a Pilagshim, Nashim b'ktuba, Pilagshim b'lo ktuba. The Rashi, which people quote a lot, seems to say that the difference between an Isha and a Pilagesh is an Isha has a ktuba, means she has a financial settlement. Whereas the Pilagesh doesn't have the financial strings attached. But it seems that otherwise, according to Rashi, a Pelegish and an Isha are very similar. The Ramban disagrees. Look at number 7, just the two lines out of the Ramban, in number 7 over the page. Rashi katav nashim b'ketuva, pilagshim shelo b'ketuva, k'da'ama b'nashim u'pilagshim de David. As he talks about the wives and the pilagshim of David, the Sanhedrin. The Ein Hadavar Kein, we're on number 7 at the top. This is not the case, says the Ramban. Ki lo tikra pelegish ela kishihi b'lo kidushin. Interesting. The lo kiddushin. Ki aktuba midibre sofrim, because the ktuba is a rabbinic innovation. There was no such thing as a ktuba at the time of Avram. But kiddushin means, what is kiddushin? Kiddushin is the formalization of a marriage. But there has to be an act of kiddushin, that they are betrothed to each other, etc. So the language doesn't have that. The Hagiz of the Sanhedrin, in fact, the version in Sanhedrin which is correct in the Ramban, is Pilegesh is the lock to the kiddushin. The Pilegesh has no ktubah, yes, for sure. She has no kiddushin either. It seems, according to the Ramban, and this is what most of the later commentaries take on, the Yaivat and others, that a Pilegesh is a woman who is in a monogamous, in the sense that she's not allowed to have any other relationships, bless you, relationship with a man, but which can be began and just ended just consensually. There's no frills, there's no ceremonies, they just agree, yes, we're going to, basically what people do when they live together today. They live together in an arrangement which is consensual, and when they decide they're not going to live with each other, they'll not live with each other. That was the situation of a Pelegish as a Ramban, and we'll see, obviously, an Isha is much more formal in that sense. So why is Keturah called a Pelegish? Is she one of these informal arrangements? Has she one of these informal arrangements with Avram? So the Ramban goes into this now further in number 8, where he goes and talks about Keturah specifically. So he says, "Bnei Pelegishim Asher Avram, Aderech HaPshat, we're still in the land of Pshat. Ba'avu Shenei Ma'alo, because it says about Avram, Ki B'Yitzchak Yikarel HaChazara Zera, because your children will be called through Yitzchak," meaning Avram is told that his children, grandchildren, great-grandchildren, will only be the children of Yitzchak. Lo b'derecher, no one else. Hayukol nashav etzlo pilagshim, therefore, in a sense, all his other wives, Hagar and Keturah, were ke'ilu pilagshim. Not that they weren't actually pilagshim, but they were, compared to the others, since their children would not really be Avram's children in the same way, they're called pilagshim. The lo yah nechshavot nashim, they weren't really on the same status and level of importance as wives. She'ein zarah b'yusha, because their children would not inherit from Avram. Ki Hagar shivcha tzarah. Now, do we see from the text that Hagar is a shivcha? Yes. Who's shivcha with Hagar? Tzarah shivcha. Where did she come from? Okay, does it say that in the text? Yes, it does. It says in the text that Hagar came from Egypt. and she was a Shifcha Asara. Hagar was a Shifcha Asara. Pileg Shohaita, says the Raman, Hagar was the Pilegesh. Why? Because she was a Shifcha, she was a servant. About Keturah le'ishalakatu. The Keturah was the real deal. Keturah was the real wife. And you see now, according to the Raman, Keturah, who was on a higher level, if you like, connected to Avram, Hagar or Keturah? This is Keturah. Hagar was a kind of a second, sort of an afterthought, because Avram and Sarah weren't able to have children, so Sarah says, take my shifcha, maybe through her we can raise a family, as it were. Okay, she's a Pilegesh. But Keturah, Keturah is a real wife. Avram, no one told Avram to marry Keturah. We'll see soon, why would he marry Keturah? Yes.
He didn't marry her until after Sarah
dies. Apparently, although it's not 100% clear.
I could have thought he could have maintained some sort of relationship, but then he sanctified it when Sarah died.
Right.
Because she was no longer there for
a child. Correct. You're raising a good question. Let's assume Keturah was not Hagar. Okay? Because if Keturah was Hagar, then it would have to be after Sarah died, because Sarah threw her out. Or she made him throw her out. If Keturah is another wife, then in the text it appears after Sarah died. But you're right, it's possible to say a mugdam mukha b'Torah, and the Torah is not always in exact chronological order because it's thematic rather than chronological, and it could be that Keturah was actually married to Abraham before. In fact, that would make some sense, because if she was only married to Abraham at this stage, then there's an awful lot of children coming now after he's 140 and etc. Yes.
About the lack of faith of Abraham and perhaps Jacob in taking these secondary wives, because Hashem has promised Abraham and going to make him into a great nation.
Good.
It took a very long time until he had a descendant, but he did have a descendant. So why did he feel the need to marry Hagar or have a child with Hagar at that stage?
Good.
An earlier stage.
You may have never heard it before, but you will hear it today, because that is exactly what source number 19 is going to talk about. And he's going to take exactly your approach, that this was a mistake from beginning to end. He should never have married Hagar, he should never have married Keturah, he should have had faith. The whole thing was a disaster.
But we don't talk about it. We talk about 10 seconds of Abraham, and surely a lack of faith would have been
So let's get to that. Let's get to that when we get to that, because it's a good point. So let's just finish off in number 8. He says, actually, Keturah was a real wife. If she was just another shivcha in his household and he took her for a pilegesh, he would have never said in the text that he married a wife and her name was Keturah. Rak tikra pilegesh, he would have called her a pilegesh. He only called her a pilegesh because of the children, they were on a lower level. Where did she come from, he says, this woman Keturah? She came from the local Canaanites. Now, what's the problem with marrying a girl from the local Canaanites? What is Avram's attitude to marrying the girls from the local Canaanites? He said he wasn't keen on it for Yitzchak. So all of a sudden, he marries a local Canaanite girl, says the Rambam. The Intomar, if you want to ask me, she had a mistress, maybe she was another mistress, or the Eretz Plishtim, or someone from far away. He didn't send off for a girl from Aram or from Mitzrayim like he did with his son. Because he's really most worried about his son. His son is a young, impressionable man. He needs a woman that's not going to bring a load of local baggage. Because the advantage of having a girl from a long way away is she doesn't bring her whole family with, then he doesn't have to, if you like, assimilate into that family. Because Yitzchak's the one that has the covenant, he's most worried about him. But Abraham can take a local girl. It doesn't say Keturah is the son of the daughter of what's his name, the Chidi, or Plishti, the Hamitzri, Neerplonit, Kaashi Amav Veneshe Esav. It says that about Esav's wives, that he tells us who they were. No, he doesn't. He just mentions the name. Aval Hiske Shma Bilvat. He just tells us her name. We'll see more about the name soon. Kihi Knani. She is a local Knani. Pekata b'yichuta. And he doesn't need to go into any particular yichus. B'chein yasra b'makomot rabim. This is what he does in many places. K'shelo yakpid b'yichus shalayim. But it's not worried about where people came from. The imha, and then he makes a suggestion. The imhaita shivcha b'veito uba eleha lo yizka yichusa. And it could be, he says, that she was actually one of his household.
meaning Avram Avinu had an enormous household of people that came along that he'd gathered up on the way as part of his Kirun outreach organization. Says maybe Keturah was one of the young, promising people as part of their entourage, and maybe even one of the students of Sarah. And when Sarah died, this was an obvious choice of a young woman to marry, because she was already in the family business, if you like. Because usually when it comes to the Imahot, it just mentions their name, just like Zilpah and Bilhah. And you see, what the Ramban is almost doing here, and this is why I call the Shir the mystery matriarch, he's almost raising Keturah to the level of one of the Imahot. Just like the Imahot, they just mention a name, and that's good enough for everybody, Bilhah, Zilpah, Keturah. So maybe Keturah was part of that league as well. So on a pshat level, it sounds like the Mephoshim is saying she's a local girl, maybe one of his entourage. In fact, there's a sforno that suggests similarly that she was one of the Nefesh Asher Asu B'charan maybe, and therefore that's also coming in the line of the Ramban. What were the gifts that he gave her children and he sent them off to the east? Again, on a pshat level, there's a Rashbam number 9, Matanot, Mamon, Harbeth. Lots of money. Kedma el Eretz Kedem. Where do these send to the east? And this is where it gets geographical, and we'll focus on this soon now. Sheyushu banav nachalotav sheyesh l'sham. That his children from Keturah would inherit his lands that he has out east. Way out east. Which land did Avraham Avinu have out east? And where is east? What do you get to if you go east of Canaan?
Jordan,
Syria,
Iraq,
Arabia, Iraq, etc., etc. There are some people we'll see later that want to suggest out east might even mean to China, and they start talking about Buddhism. We'll see that there are connections, but on a pshat level, that's clearly not the case. Eretz Kedem on a pshat level means the Arabian desert, okay, the big, vast desert land to the east of Israel. And we'll see now what does it mean that he had lands out to the east. Let's have a look for a second at number 11. We'll skip number 10 for now. There is a mention later on in the in Tehillim to the Hagarim. We'll talk about them soon as well. Maybe these are also part of the same family. Let's look at number 11. What land was Avraham Avinu promised? So if I was to ask before we get into the... If you ask most people, what was the promised land to Abraham? The answer is... Right, the land which God would show him. Where did he get? Well, that's an interesting point, actually. Because if Lech Lecha was said to him when he was still living in Haran or whatever, then what was the land that God showed him? Round there, everything on the way. Which way did Avram come down into Israel? But that we know because it says explicitly at the beginning of Lech Lecha, he came from Haran, he came down from through Mesopotamia, and down through Syria and Lebanon. The Syrian Jews have this tradition that he went to Aleppo, of course, on his way down to Israel. They don't say that anywhere, but they know that. He went to Aleppo and then he came down through Shechem, what is now the Route 60. You drive through Israel down the Route 60, you drive from Shechem down through Bet to Beth El to Yerushalayim, Bet Lechem, Hebron, and eventually goes it veers to the west to Be'er Sheva. That is exactly the route, it's in the same place. Where just around the corner from my house is a little road they call Derech Avot. We don't know if it's the road that Avraham Avinu walked down, but it's certainly the road from Second Temple period, because it's got the Roman milestones and the mikvahs from Second Temple period. That was the route that people took north to south. So what was the land that Avraham Avinu was promised? So look at number 11. There were two britots with Avraham Avinu and Parshas Lech Lecha. And this is where we have to really get into this issue of Keturah. The first brit is called the Brit Ben HaBetarim. Look at number 11. Vayomahu karat Hashem et Avram brit leimor. On that day, God made a brit with Avram, saying, "Lezaracha natati et haaretz hazot. I am giving you this land, this to your children. I'm giving this land. Which land? Minahar Mitzrayim ad Nahar Agadol Nahar Prat. From the river of Egypt to the river of the Euphrates. Now, the Euphrates. There's no question about where the Euphrates is. What Nahar Mitzrayim?
Nile.
Could be the Nile. It could be Suez, around the Suez area, El Arish, around there. But it could be the Nile. Now, from the Nile to the Euphrates,
that's a fairly big, when people talk about Greater Israel as a political concept, you don't mean from the mouth of the Euphrates. If you look in this map here, at the bottom of the page, this seems to be roughly the land which is the greatest understanding of Greater Israel's borders. As far as I'm aware, there's no political party that's seeking to extend Israel's influence and borders to there. Although the truth is, if you look in the Iranian textbooks, this is that the only place where you'll see Israel defined in that way, because that's how they say that's where Israel wants to be. They go to the Tanakh and they say, look, it says from the mouth of the Euphrates, that's what Israel's looking to occupy. Anyway, that's another point. Well, the point is the Brit Ben Abatarim seems to include all this land, and it gives all these tribes. There's Hakeni, there's Haknizi, there's Kadmoni, there's Achiti, there's Aprizi, there's Rephaim, remember the Rephaim in a minute, there's Aimori, remember them as well, there's Kanani, there's Gigashi, there's Yibusi. All those tribes are in this area. However, later on, there's another Brit, which is the second Brit with Avram, the Brit that everyone knows about. Which Brit is you got to do with Avram? Brit Milah, the Brit Milah. But that came much later, and there's a different land promised. In the Brit Ben Abatarim, there is an entire region from the mouth of the Euphrates. In the Brit Milah, look at number 12. The Natati Lachal Zaracha, I will give to you and your children, Achra after you, et ha'aret eret mugurecha, the land where you live, et kol eret Kanaan, the land of Canaan, la'achuzat olam, for a permanent position, fa'iti lahem la'elohim, and I will be a God for you. Two different britos, two different lands. In the Brit Ben Abatarim, Avram's promises the enormous land from the Mount of Euphrates. In the Brit Milah, Aram is promised the land of Canaan. The usual borders of the land of Canaan are Midan, Ad, Beersheba. Midan from Dan to Beersheba, which is a tiny amount of land compared to the mouth of the Euphrates. What's going on with these two britot? Which is the real promised land? And here we see that there are two promised lands. There's the land that belongs to Yitzhak and Yaakov and their children, which is Eretz Kanaan. And there is the land that belongs to Bnei Avraham, meaning Bnei Ishmael, Bnei Keturah, Bnei Lot, which is Minar Ad Prat, Minar Mitzrayim Ad Prat. Have a look here at a letter focused on passage from Parshas Lech Lecha. Remember, there's a story of the four kings and the five kings in Lech Lecha. It seems to come in the middle for no apparent reason. It seems that one of the reasons it's there, of course, is who is captured as part of the four kings and the five kings?
Lot.
And Avraham Avinu has to go chasing after Lot to bring Lot back. But other than that sort of side storyline of Lot, what is the purpose for us knowing about this entire world war in ancient history in the middle of the Bible, in the middle of the Chumash? Well, what moral lessons is it there to teach us? So have a look in number 13. This is from the four kings and the five kings. In the 14th year, it came along Chadala Omer, Bahamalachim Asheito, and all the kings that were with him, these are the four kings. The Yaku et, and who did they destroy? The Yaku means they wiped out the following groups of people. Et Rephaim, they wiped out the Rephaim, the Ashtar Karnaim, the Et HaZuzim, the Zuzim, okay, they wiped out the Zuzim. Baham, the Et Ha'imim. So they destroyed the Zuzim, the Et Ha'imim, and also the Aimim, the Shava Kiryatayim, in this place Shava Kiryatayim, the Et Ha'chori, the Hararam, Seir, and in Har Seir, these four kings wiped out the Chori, Ad El Paran, all the way to El Paran, Asha'al Amidbar in the desert, the Yashuvi of Vol El Ein Mishpat, and they came all the way to Ein Mishpat, Havei Kadesh, which is Kadesh, the Yaku et Kol Sadeh Amaleki, and they wiped out the Amalekim. The Gamet Amorim, they wiped out the Amorim, and Yoshe Bechetzon Tamar. This list of obscure ancient civilizations, this another obscure ancient civilization, went rampaged through the Middle East and wiped them out one by one. Why do I need to know about this? Why do you need to read about this? Why do we lame this in Shul? Why is it important for us as Jews in 2017 that these people wiped out all these other people? So the answer is that when you look later in Dvarim, when Moshe Rabbeinu is giving his pep talk to the Jewish people as they're about to go into the land, look at what he says to them in number 14. says, God said to me, Al tatsar et Moav. Don't start up with Moav. Don't start with Moav. Va'al tikgar ba milchama. Don't go to war against Moav. We weren't allowed to fight Moav. Ki lo etinacha me'ad so Yerusha. Because you, the Jewish people, are not allowed to be in the land of Moab. Because who does that belong to? Kilid b'nei Lot natati et ar v'yish Yerusha. I've given this to b'nei Lot. You can't take that. That belongs to b'nei Lot, so you can't go and fight with them. And then Moshe tells them that ha'einim l'fanim yashvula. Before Lot, the b'nei Lot, before Moab came there, the einim used to live there. And gadol, a great people, v'rav, many people, v'ram ka'anakim, like giants, these people were. Rafa'im yichashvu, Rafa'im was one of the nations, it says, that was destroyed by the kings there. There were Rafa'im, Abhaim ka'anakim, they were also like giants. V'ha'moavim yikru'u lahem einim. The Moabim would even call them Einim, or Tseima, like fear. Okay? Ubeseir, Yashua Charim, and he gives them another history lesson. And it used to be back in the day that in Seir lived the Chorim, the Fanim, back in the day. Ubnei Esav Yerushal, and the Bnei Esav captured that land. The Yashmidun Mipnehem, and they managed to wipe them out. The Yeshu Tachtam, Ka'ashe Asa Yisrael, Eretz Yerushasa Hashem Atan Hashem Lahem. And they lived there just like we have lived already in the other side of the Jordan, which has already been conquered. The Karav Tamul B'nei Amon, and then the Jewish people got to Amon, which was the next country along. And he said, Al Tetzuram, don't start up with Amon. The Al Tetzgarbam, don't annoy Amon either. Ki lo eten me'eretz b'nei Amon l'chai l'isha, because you don't have the land of Amon either. Ki l'vnei lot natati al Yerusha, because I've given that to b'nei lot. Eretz Rifa'im, here they come again, these Rifa'im, the land of the Rifa'im. Techashiv Avhid Rifa'im, this was also the land of Rifa'im. Yashvu Ba'al Rifa'im, they lived there before. The Ha'amonim yikru'u lahem Zamzumim. And the Ammonim called them Zamzumim, Am Gadol, the Rav, the Ram, Ka'anakim, tall like giants, the Ashvidim, Hashem, Yuknehem, etc. And he goes on again and again. All these people used to live here, but don't worry because Moab lives here, you can't start with Moab, that's not your land. Ammon lives here now, Esav lives here. What's going on? There's two things are going on. Number one, Moshe Rabbeinu is giving the people a pep talk and saying, look, you're the children of Avram Avinu. God promised you that he'd give you this land. And you're worried about going into the land of Canaan. Don't worry, because this has already been done. Because Moab, who you're not allowed to start with because they're also children of Avram Avinu, so they have their place, they did their wars already. And these people were just as giants and just as scary, and they dealt with them. Ammon, they did the same thing. Esav, he did the same thing. If they can do it, you can do it, because they managed to fulfill this prophecy. Meaning, Moshe is saying to the people, this is a prophecy which is already almost fulfilled when it comes to the non-Jewish nations around us, which are children of Abraham. If they can do it, you can do it too. And therefore, all of these other people that we're talking about are extended family of Avram Avinu too. And I brought you a few maps. You can have a quick look at a few maps. Here you see the Ammonites and the Moabites and the Edomites. They are all the land. So this map on the left is the land at the time of Yoshua. So Ammon, Moab and Edom is off to the east. And these are obviously all still Bnei Avram Avinu. And then if you go even broader, even wider, you see that in the Arabian Peninsula, you here see Sheba. See Sheba there? Mm-hmm. And Yoktan. There's all sorts of interesting people over there. If you go over the page also, I brought you a map at the bottom of the page where it says E at the top, that's east at the top, which is a little bit like the map we're looking at there. You see, we're not used to seeing the map of the Middle East from this angle. But if you see here, these are also, you see it says Keturah in the middle here. Mm-hmm. Basically the B'nai Keturah, rather warm here. The B'nai Keturah are the people who ended up settling the Arabian Peninsula. And therefore, on a pshat level, I brought you this piece from Rav Yaakov Meidan in number 15, that we'll just dip into a little bit here. Rav Meidan is one of the Rosh Yeshiva in Eretz Yisrael, in Haretzion. Rav Meidan basically brings this idea out as well. And he says, if you look in the second paragraph of number 15, you called?
The
Gael. The Gael. I can.
Gael over here. Okay.
Can you
That's interesting, because Shem really is the father of all of these people. Maybe this is just a sort of a... Well, Shem, what do you mean? Ham is in this rhyme, absolutely. Because exactly, Ham was meant to be. If you look at the people who are Ham, the sons of Ham back in Parshas Noah are Mitzrayim, Cush, Put, all those people who are basically in Africa. Shem are meant to be the Semites who are in the Middle East, but then they were focused, and Yafet are meant to be the Europeans. Who is the grandson of Yafet? Yavan, Greece. Okay, Yavan is Greece. And therefore, and we'll see soon that this is basically focusing in on Avraham Avinu, that when this land belongs to Shem, who is Shem now? Shem is your family, your extended family. And therefore, Avraham Avinu has to somehow fill this land. Now, Shem goes beyond. From the north to the Euphrates is a certain area, but beyond the Euphrates and all of Saudi Arabia, etc., there are also the Semites in that sense, and therefore that's the wider family of Shem. And I'm not going to read through this whole piece by Rav Yaakov, Midah number 15, but he brings out this idea that, look at the second paragraph. Why did he have to have more children? Well, he's just going to send them away. What's the point of having all these extra children when he just sends them out east? But he's saying, Avram is kol ha-shalo Yitzchak, he brings the posse. The Asher, it could be, he says, שהצורך צורך של אברהם להוליד בנים רבים קשור בהבדל שבין שתי הבריתות שקרת עמו הקדוש ברוך הוא. It's these two בריתות. One is the brit בין הבתרים, and one is the brit mina, and that's why he has to have these other children. And he goes on to say that the land that he has to fill is far too big for the Jewish people to fill. The Jewish people cannot possibly fill all the land from the mouth of the Euphrates. Okay, we can't even fill up Eretz Yisrael. You know, if you go driving around Eretz Yisrael, there are, you know, deserts and hills and endless land. Not endless, but it's Eretz Yisrael is called Eretz HaTzvi, because the skin of a deer. If you stretch it and stretch it and stretch it, you can get more and more people in it. People ask, like, how could all the Jewish people possibly fit in Eretz Yisrael? Plenty of land in Eretz Yisrael. There aren't that many of the Jewish people. That's the truth. You know, how many Jewish people live outside Eretz Yisrael? Maybe 7 million? You can find place for another 7 million people. Don't worry, we'll squish up a bit here and we'll squish up a bit there. We'll work it out. But to fill the whole land from the Nazi Euphrates, that you need a broader family. And therefore, he says, it could be, look in where I've underlined the 4 or 5 paragraphs in, Amnon ein b'kocho shel am Yisrael lachlet et ha-shtachim ha-nirvachim shel Eretz zo. It's not possible for a small nation like the Jewish people to fill all of this land, the et nidborateha, all the deserts ha-gidolim, Achi Kaim Hashem et Bukato, until God fulfills his promise, etc. The Yosef Aleinu Elef Panim, God would have to make it much bigger, and in fact that's it. Zinira Shizoni Yasibala Kafsha Avram Holid Banim Rabin. That's why Avram had his children, the Shilchami Ali Yitzchak, but no, and he sends them out east. Now it's interesting. East is an interesting direction. What was the route that went through these deserts out east? The spice route. And what are the names of many of these people? People called Keturah. What's Keturah mean? Spices. Yes, incense. Even the word Lot is the name of a spice. Basmat, which is one of the family of Avram through Esau, is a spice. Maybe even Sipporah, who of course comes from which family? Midian. Who is one of the Benot Keturah. Tiporah is also a spice. It could be that this is basically Avraham Avinu's design. He wants to spread monotheism through the known world. What better way to do that is on the spice route to get his children, basically, as the traders. Even though they weren't even Jewish, they had an international trade network, you see, and they could go around the Middle East in that way. And therefore, that is, if you like, on a shout level, what's going on with Keturah. If you look, please, on page number 5, we'll do a few more sources, we'll have a little break. If you look on page number 5 here, you'll see that in many ways Chazal see Avram as being the new establisher of the world. Number 16, Chazal say, Shalosh Nashim Nasa Avram. Avram married 3 wives. Sarah, Bito Shel Shem. Sarah came from Shem, because Sarah was from the family of Terach. Keturah, Bito Shel Yefet. Keturah from Yefet.
and Hagar Beit Shel Ham, and Hagar from Ham. In that sense, almost like Abraham's got the whole world covered. He's got one wife from Europe, one wife from Africa, one wife from Asia. You're done. Okay? And in this sense, it sees Chazal see it in the same way. So too, in number 17, Chazal is almost like compared to a new Noah. That Noah, just like Noah had to fill the world, Abraham also has to fill the world, build families, 30 families to fill the world. And that's actually interestingly also, just look at number 18, then we'll get to the point that the lady made over there. And number 18 is a source from Sefer Yovlin. What is Sefer Yovlin? Not quoted that much, the Book of Jubilees. What is the Book of Jubilees? To be quite precise, it's in the pseudepigrapha, meaning it doesn't find its way into the Catholic Bible either, but it is a Second Temple book, which is not necessarily from Jewish sources, although it may be, sectarian book. Sectarian Jewish sources, there were lots of these in the time of the Second Temple. Think of the Dead Sea sects as well, various different people, Sadukim, Baitusin, etc. The Book of Jubilees was a book written around the 2nd century BCE, which never made it into Tanakh. In fact, there are many things that it says, which are very interestingly parallels of rabbinic law of the time, but with a different answer. And many of the dinim that the rabbis created, that they understand to be rabbinic in nature, Sefer Yovlin quotes these, but gives the death penalty for them. Now, this is not a halacha. Sefer Yovlin is outside the halachic system, but one of the things that Chazal were fighting, if you like, in the late Second Temple period, is these sectarians which were much more strict in their application of halakha. For example, the Book of Jubilees says that if you ride a horse on Shabbat, you're liable to the death penalty. Now, riding a horse on Shabbat is a rabbinic prohibition. In halacha, no one would ever be liable to the death penalty, even if there were a death penalty for riding a horse on Shabbat. So Sefer Yovlin reflects other perspectives, if you like, of what was going on in the Second Temple times. It's certainly not quoted as a Jewish, if you like, source, but it is a reflection on what's going on at the time. So have a look. It also talks about Keturah, number 18. Avram lakach lo isha shlishit. Avram takes a third one. Ushma Keturah. And her name was Keturah. Miyaldei Beitoh. And very explicitly it says, she was one of his household, like the Ramban suggested. Ki meita Hagar lifnei Sarah, because Hagar died already before Sarah. Bateled lo banim shisha, and she had six children, Zinbar, which we didn't see in the text of the Chumash, the Yochshan u'Madai u'Madaf, also a slightly different name, the Yazbuk, the Sechi, the Shnei Shavuot Shanim. She had them over 14 years. The Book of the Jubilees is very much into these Jubilee cycles of 7s and 50s, which is why it's called the Book of Jubilees. That's not for now. Vayitel Yishmael b'nol of Mekhtura Matanot v'yishachem me'al Yitzchak b'nol, says the Book of Jubilees, he sent them out from his son Yitzchak. Vayelech Yishmael v'nav uv'nei Keturah uv'neihem yachda. Says, and at that point, the B'nei Yishmael, the B'nei Keturah, they combined. They lived all the way out towards Babel. Basically, this is Arabia, the Arabian Peninsula, out towards Iraq. All of the land there to the east, Mula Yishimon, out in the wilderness. The Yit Arvu, Eileb Eileb, they all mixed in together. The Yikra Shmam Arab. And now we call them Arabs. Arab. Okay? Interesting. Bishmaelim. And Ishmael. This, of course, this source was written 800, 900 years before Islam. So Arabs didn't just come on the scene at the time of Muhammad. Arabs were a whole group of people, nomads, living in that Arabian Peninsula. And again, our perspective very much is that these are the B'nai Keturah, in that sense, and the B'nai Ishmael. Now let's just finish here before we have a break for a minute, or 5 or 6 minutes, with the point that the lady made over there. What's your name, sorry?
Minky.
The Minky made over there. Did Avram do the right thing? On a pshat level. So, you never hear it suggested that he did the wrong thing. I found this source in the Sfor Amor, which is a 15th century source, which says that he did do the wrong thing. Look at what he says here. Number 19. Kvar kasavti lemala de'inyan Hagar. I've already written about Hagar. Kishenitna lo Sarah, when Sarah gave Hagar to him, she'asa Avraham shelo kahoget. He did something inappropriate. He'd already been promised he was going to have a child, Yitzchak. The Afal Pishet Sarah Nitna Loim, though Sarah said, marry Hagar. Ulai Yibane Mimeno, maybe he'll be built through Hagar. Lo Haya Lo Lishmole Devareha. He should never have listened to Sarah.
Interesting. Should Avram listen to Sarah? Isn't that what they always quote? So that's his point. Then when God says to Abraham, now you should listen to Sarah, because now I'm telling you to listen to Sarah, but back then when you listened to Sarah, who told you to listen to Sarah? Meaning if you're going to listen to your wife, you need a command from God to listen to your wife, otherwise why would you listen to your wife? Okay, so he says he should never have listened to her. The Indian share bezeh chata. He actually sinned in doing this. But nolad mizeh Yishmael, and he ended up having a little Yishmael. And then he added to his sin, and he davened to Yishmael, and he said, "Lo Yishmael yichiel lefanecha, please God that Yishmael should live in front of you." Like that's even worse. Not only did he give birth to Yishmael, but he davened for Yishmael as well. This is a very unusual source. Most people don't read it like this at all. Most people read Yishmael as being very, and we'll see that Chazal, the rabbi, saw Yishmael as being almost like a hero, which is why they called their children Yishmael. We'll see. The Lomi Karel the Hagar, Rahoisif Al Kheta. And he wasn't, he added on to his, he hadn't cooled down, if you like, from Hagar, and he was still davening for her. And he took a new wife, Et Keturah, Rahoilid Banim Rabim Mimenu, and all of these sons that he had from Keturah became the Pach Ule Mokesh Israel, a snare and a trap for the Jewish people. Look at all the trouble we had from them. Moisif, in addition to our B'nei Ishmael. A different perspective. That Avraham Avinu basically messed up big time when he married these wives and had these children, and he shouldn't have done that. And in fact, there may be a hint to that in, we'll finish with this just for a few minutes, in number 20. There's one of the stories in Sanhedrin where there was the, if you like, the United Nations of the time was the court of Alexander the Great. So there are a whole list of Midrashim in Sanhedrin towards the end there in Perek Chelek, where it says in number 20, the Shuv Pam Achad, there was another time, Ba'u B'nei Yishmael U'B'nei Keturah. The sons of Yishmael and the sons of Keturah came, Ladun Am Yisrael, Ladun Im Yisrael, Lifnei Alexander Smokdom. To bring the Jews to court in front of Alexander Macedonia. Amulot, if they said to Alexander, Eretz Kanan Shelanu U'Shelachem. Eretz Kanan belongs to us and to you. This is a two-state solution. The Ksivah says, Ve'ela told us Yishmael ben Abraham. Yishmael is the son of Abraham. We can say Ve'ela told us Yishmael ben Abraham. So Amalahem, Givir ben Patitiel Chachamim, and the story goes on to say how they basically warded off this international. This is the early versions of what they now call lawfare. Okay, you know the expression lawfare? That basically one of the ways that of international community fighting against each other is by taking people to the international court. So what's going on at the moment with Israel in the political arena? There's one arena which is a military arena. There's another arena which is a Hasbara arena. There's another arena which is a legal arena, which is lawfare. You have to take this to the United Nations, that to the United Nations. None of this is new at all. Chazal already talked about this idea that the B'nai Keturah and the B'nai Yishmael used whatever means they could, and when they couldn't fight militarily, they used legal appeals, if you like, to go to Alexander to say that they wanted to claim their part of the land. And the story of what happened there is an interesting one, and how the Jews managed to win Alexander onto their side, which is one of the reasons, by the way, why Alexander became a Jewish name, because Alexander was, if you like, one of our heroes. But just to summarize part one, if you like, on a pshat level, what is the purpose of this very obscure Keturah and her six sons? The answer is the Brit Bein HaBetarim. The Brit Bein HaBetarim, if you like, you might even call it the Forgotten Brit, because most people focus on the Brit Milah, but the Brit Bein HaBetarim was the Brit for Avram's general descendants. Why? They're beyond the Jewish people. But these are all Bnei Abraham, these are all cousins of ours. In fact, the Israelis today refer to Arabs as Bnei Dodim, as cousins, because we are cousins from Avraham Avinu, okay? Because families can often cause problems, okay? Even siblings, never mind cousins. But nevertheless, they're all part of that. The Brit Milah, okay, that's Eretz Kanaan, that's the nation only of Yitzchak and Yaakov, and that's a different story. So that's on the pshat level. In a few minutes, if we take a break for have a walk around, get some oxygen, we're going to turn our heads completely in a different direction. It's almost a new shift to a drash level. On the level of drash, what did Chazal see in the story of Keturah? And we'll see they had a different reading entirely. It was a focus on the family, a focus of Abraham, Yitzhak, and the relationship between them, the relationships between Sarah and Abraham, etc., and the concept of being a Baal Tshuva. A completely different take, which we'll see in a few minutes, but let's stop there for a few minutes. I'll stop the tape and hopefully be able to start it again when we're ready to go. Okay, that was good. That was 59 minutes, 33 seconds. Okay, so 10-minute break, and then we're back on. And we'll probably finish a little early because I need to get to Worcester this afternoon. Worcester. It is, isn't it?